Welcome to the movie group, everybody. We're going to be discussing Inception, a 2.5 hour investment of your time. Hope you all got a chance to watch it. And as Don said 30 minutes prior to this show, if you haven't watched it already, probably didn't have time. So I watched part of it with Regina and some of the folks at the retreat, and I think Regina watched the rest of it at a later time. So I hope everybody that didn't get a chance to finish it, who I was with watching it the other day, I hope you had a chance to. So here we are. Glad you're all here. Welcome. And we have both Susans in the house. Hey, Susan Fady. How you doing? That's the correct way to pronounce your name, by the way. I wanted to make sure of that. Fady? Okay. Thank you. Hey, Ron, what's up? I didn't get a chance to say goodbye before you left, but I see you're back home safe. Yeah, we had a great time. It was neat to be with everybody and build a sense of family amongst each other. It was nice. Okay, well, let's just dive in. This movie was incredibly popular. $829 million worldwide gross. It's listed in the top movies of all time of all movies in terms of how high amount of money that it brought in. So it's very popular. Whether you go into the spiritual implications of it or not, it rang true. It resonated in the minds of, I think, all people. You know, if you're interested in pursuing this sort of spirituality or not, it had a resonance that people just liked. And that's really what the first question, if you want to get your play sheet out, we can go through the questions. If you also have any other commentary that aren't specifically covered in the play sheet, I really invite you to share that as well. So the first question in the first part of the film, Cobb, who is played by Leonardo DiCaprio, describes the mind projecting perception and us believing that very perception is happening so fast we don't even notice it happening. And he drew a circle with arrows. And this is when he was meeting with Ariadne in a cafe on a street, and she didn't realize it was a dream at the moment. And he was describing where they enter in terms of inception, right in between where the mind creates and then before that next moment where the mind then believes what it's perceiving as real, right in that little space in there. Regina did sort of talk about that recently, but I wanted to open it up to see what that made you think of, what that stimulated in your insights. And don't think it's obvious, and don't think we all already know this because we talk about it. It's not obvious. Let's talk about it. Let's bring out what it is you see in that and what you've experienced with it. So who would like to take the mic first? Okay, Ron, go for it. Yeah, I don't hear you, Ron.
Can you hear me all right?
Now I can. Now I can, yes.
So I had a chance to kind of write down the specific thing that Cobb said when he was there at the cafe with, what was the gal's name, the actress's role?
The character name was Ariadne.
Ariadne.
Yeah.
Says that in the dream, our mind is continually doing this. We create and we perceive our world simultaneously. This happens so fast, and our mind does this so well, we don't know that it's happening. I think it kind of reminded me of, in a sense of Bernadette Roberts' teaching of the mind bending on itself, I guess is another way of just a different variation on the theme that we're creating and perceiving. Again, if the mind is bent on itself, as soon as we create, we perceive, because it's, you know, we have that that bent part. But it's really, you know, just it's the movie has so many things to think about. She asks, Ariadne asked where the people came from, and Cobb said, well, it's the projections of my subconscious. So he didn't even know specifically where they came from, except that they came from his subconscious. He could point them out and say, yeah, I thought about that one, that's where it came from. You know, it just kind of filled that part that we're not conscious of is filling space. So it's just, to me, it was just a real life example of how, or an example of how something that is truly not real and just created can be experienced as real. It was just fascinating.
Yeah, that was really well said, Ron. Thank you. I also can share from something that I think it was 126. This is maybe a tip. Poole wrote Gentle Healing Year One, referencing loop, which is what I think I see, which is perceive. What I see, I experience. What I experience, I think. This might be also called mind-made illusions. So, as we talk about 100 times, right, we see through the filter of our beliefs, our conditioning. You know, I am a teacher. I am living in La Vida, whatever it is. I have headphones on my head. You know, I am speaking right now, and therefore I believe that, and therefore that's what my mind is getting filled with. You know, when I leave that, when I become super present in the moment, and as was just mentioned, let go of the memories, because those memories are the only thing that gives us that sense of time, right? That loop, that kit, that anchoring in that conditioning, that I can be free of that. That's the only way, is to be in that moment right now, free of that. You know, and this is what the whole idea he was trying to do in the movie was, to plant a new idea into a mind that for every other reason wouldn't ever be accepted, to dissolve this guy's empire. But I like to look at that as a metaphor, planting an idea in our minds that we can dissolve all the conditioning we hold as dear and important. And just like that billionaire's son, who is all set to inherit this energy fortune, he actually ended up accepting and having a positive emotional reaction to the idea of completely dismantling the entire fortune. That movie, it was so he could be his own man and not live after his father. We could substitute that for, we want truth. We want to live and walk with God in the moment. That is what we want. And that is, me motivating to help let go of that conditioning. Does anyone else, Regina, did you want to repeat or share what you had taught about that?
Well, I had the same thing you had when you asked, what teaching does this remind us of? I had what I think I see, what I see I experience, and what I experience I think. That's what I had for number one.
Number two, there was a process called shared dreaming that the team practiced with the help of sedatives. I don't think Regina would approve of a workshop if I want to offer. We all get hooked up to IVs and have drugs and have shared dreams as a retreat idea. I don't think that would fly. But this experience seemed very real to them while they were inside the dream state. What spiritual teaching is this an allegory for? Who would like to share? Shauna, go ahead.
Just that our false reality feels really real to us until we begin to see that it's not. So that was my thought.
Absolutely beautiful, Shauna. That was really cool. That was perfect. Regina, go ahead.
Yeah, well, when I read this question, it reminded me of the scene when they went to visit the chemist who was going to make the sedative, and he talked about the people that were downstairs that came there to dream. I think it was like 12 hours a day or something like that, and they had a man that was watching them dream, and they asked, how come they come down here every day to dream? And his answer was, they come here to wake up. To them, the dream world had become the real world. And so that's kind of our situation, right? The dream world has become the real world. So that's all I had for that particular answer. That's what stood out for me, was that particular scene.
Yeah, that totally sent chills up my spine when I saw that scene, and that the dream caretaker guy who himself looked pretty creepy, you know, looked at him and he said, "Who are you to say otherwise?" And it's just like, whoa, we have accepted this as, but it's like, we're okay with waking up from our dreams and go to sleep, right? And yeah, we all know that's a dream, but then what's a dream? That's not so easy to convince ourselves is a dream, right? We have forgotten. Romans 9, you know, if you've studied that, you know, burn it into your brain. It's really good to just memorize those teachings because read them hundreds of times, as many times as you need to. I mean, it's it was an experiment at first, and then it became a trap. Just like how Cobb advised Ariadne when he was teaching her, don't ever be the architect of things in your actual memories because you're going to lose track of the fact that you're dreaming and you're going to get lost. Remember? And of course, then she busted him later because he wasn't even following his own advice and he was still trying to hold on to his own memory. So he was just being a hypocrite. But I take that as an allegory because, you know, when we, but also the shared part, a thing I want to throw in about with the shared part, like I say to Dawn, "Oh, Dawn, wasn't that incredible when so-and-so said this?" And Dawn's like, "Yeah," or, didn't that really suck when this happened? And maybe Shauna will agree and say, "Yeah, that was terrible." Now, I don't think Regina would do that. Regina would just look at me and smile and I'd go, "Oh, I'm making this up. All right, thanks." But maybe we can all do that for each other. Eventually we'll just, you know, look at each other and smile instead of joining each other in our stories. But this shared dreaming, I now hear as us making up stories. And that's a big insight I had when I was at the Freedom from the Judge retreat with Jacqueline about how it's all a con. Everything's a story. It's not just the things we're making up that aren't really true or didn't really happen in the dream. It's we give meaning to the things in the dream. And we agree on it. That's the shared. Go ahead, Dawn.
What is coming through recently with all this inquiry I'm doing is even, okay, like, so when you have a thought and a thought just randomly pops into your head and it could be a memory or whatever it is, that is a dream world right there. And what ends up happening is it comes so quick. If you don't slow it down and stop it and see there's a direct correlation in your body, that felt sense of tension or angst or fear or whatever the correlating thought may be, your body believes it automatically. They say when we're children, the brain waves are so different that you're almost like in a state of hypnosis when you're a child. So whatever is said to you, and you're looking at these big giant people when you're only this little or however little you are, and it's almost like they're godlike to you because they're so big and they're providing for you and they're giving you shelter and food. And so it's the state of hypnotism, which you can think is like a dream. And so what I've noticed recently is even like a memory is a thought, and it's a dream world. Every memory it has a correlating dream factor to it. And the hypnosis part of it, or the dreaming upon the dreaming upon the dreaming, is where I will have a memory. And this just happened last night to me. I was lying in bed and I had memories of certain places I'd been or visited or jobs I've had in the past and ways I used to be, like say in my 20s, and I'm not like that now. But instantly when the place or job, whatever I was doing back then came to my mind, instantly there was this feeling of being scared or angst or whatever. And then I just caught it. I just caught the dream in motion. So that's almost like having a lucid dream where you're dreaming, but you're like, "Oh my God, I see that. That's a dream. I'm dreaming." And then what took it another step is I realized that that memory is only a thought and I can believe it or not. And then I start playing around with, well, just like how you do the work on thoughts like "I'm a loser" or "I'm not good enough" or "he doesn't love me" or all those thoughts, like, you know, you could question. I started doing the work on the thoughts of like that setting or that place. And is that true? And I realized when I started questioning that memory, is it true? I suddenly realized, oh my God, no, it's not. It's not happening right now. I would think back to our places like, Dawn, you don't even know if that place exists anymore. That person you used to date, they could be dead right now. Or you don't know. You haven't talked to them in 20 years. How do you know what's happening to them? They could be no longer on this planet. So it was like literally I could see how these memories, which are thoughts, are fantasies, which are dreams. So therefore, it makes sense that it's the dream upon the dream upon the dream. And because of the mechanism of the mind, where we want to be right all the time, this whole built-in believer, there's a believer, because that's what we learned how to adapt as children. Believe what mommy and daddy say are true, because it's almost like there's a safety attached to that. I'll be safe if I do what mommy and daddy says. I won't get hurt. So the believer part of the mind kicked in, which that isn't who you are, but that's how we make the dream. We believe the thoughts, which are the dream. That's the creation. And then we fortify each dream and make it seem even more real when we tell it, share it. And someone like Jay just said so perfectly, yeah. Oh my God, I can't believe that happened to you. Oh my God, I can't believe she said that to you. How dare she? You know, and so it fortifies, it almost like, even though it's a dream, it's not true. It's a total illusion. And what you started from was an illusion in the beginning because it was a fantasy of something that wasn't even real. Because these places may not even exist anymore in my mind. It's places I've worked, people I've talked to. So it's literally fantasy. Memory is fantasy. And what was happening even last night as I was playing with this, doing the work on memories, aka thoughts, what was happening was not a bad thing. Each time one would let go, it would just anchor me into this moment, into the body. I could feel all this aliveness, just coming forth of like, I could just feel my own presence. And it just kept happening where I was like, well, maybe that's not even true. Maybe that's not even true. And all I'm left with is what's here now. That's all. That's all I'm left with. So that's what I'm working with right now. So we'll see what happens from here.
What a great attitude. Let's see what happens from here. And the sedatives that they gave to be in that dreaming state, I look at as our beliefs and our conditioning. Because doesn't our conditioning lull us into a sleep state? Just operating along with our same habitual patterns, blah, blah, blah. Aren't those sedatives? They kind of are. Who would disagree with that? I mean, that's exactly what Dawn was talking about. I mean, that's how we sedate ourselves. And Dawn is like, forget that sedation. I'm going to be here, present. I mean, let's all join Dawn in that. Let's do that right now. Let's all do that. Let go of our sedatives. Kick the habit, right? And Regina wrote, yes, I agree. Those are sedatives. Ron, take the mic.
Yeah, just a couple quick things. One of the things we worked on this last week was this whole idea of inattention. That's our sedative is inattention. So we were working on being attentive. A couple things that struck me and from the beginning of the movie to where you're at right now is when Ariandre came out of the when she came back, you know, Cobb had predicted she was going to come back, and when she came back, she's, you know, his assistant had to ask her, you know, why'd you come back? She goes, it's pure creation. She had this sense of wonder. And it made me almost think, it's like, gosh, on the second principle of God, when consciousness first moved and saw maybe what, you know, what was created from that, is kind of like it fell in love with its own creation. In a sense, it's just kind of a thought. So on the different layers of the dream, you know, this is consciousness's dream. It's not, and yes, we have our dream within the dream too. We have our aspect of it. This is consciousness's dream. At least that's a thought that kind of struck me. I just wanted to share. I'm giving up the mic.
That is so cool, Ron. I had this huge insight right as you said that You remember that sheet of paper analogy that Regina talked about like this? It just occurred to me is that what we call when the mind split was actually this occurring. It didn't really split. Oh my gosh, that's it. That's what it was. And then we hear the Holy Spirit. And it was always this. That, oh my gosh, that was the split. That was consciousness having a dream. That was it. It's not really a split. I could never put that together when they said the mind isn't really split. It just seems like it's split. And that is such a perfect, what Regina shared and then what you just shared, Ron, made so much sense. Thank you for that. Wow.
And when you bend it like that, it looks like a C for creation.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah. That's a good thought. Thank you, Dawn. Wow, what a cherry on top. That's awesome. Okay. There was a brief reference. This is question 3. Did you have anything to share, Regina? No. 3. There was a brief reference to the, quote, raw infinite subconsciousness and falling into limbo. Please comment on the context of this and share your thoughts. Now, this is at a totally different part of the dream, of the movie, which is a dream. It's at the end of the movie, and they're already in, like, 2 layers down, right? And they're going in, and this where Cato is an old man. I just threw that question in the play sheet because that's not a reference. That's a direct non-dual reference to the absolute or to something, you know, really to the absolute as I would see it, or consciousness perhaps. But raw, undifferentiated, I think he called it subconscious. And the whole effect of the time dilation, which is a later question. But does anyone have a thought to share? I mean, that was my thought, is that it was at the absolute. But go ahead, Dawn.
Okay, so I can't speak from the absolute or anything like that. But when I think of limbo, I think of how it's been for me for the last 10 years. Like, since I started on the spiritual path, for me, the perfect way to describe it is how Eckhart Tolle called it no man's land. And that's how it's felt until very, very recently, where I was neither here nor there. I really, really, really felt like something was off, that I hadn't got it yet, understood it yet, but I knew I didn't want the world the way it was with all the suffering and the chaos that, you know, was going on in here and out there. So with a lot of clarity and inquiry, now it's becoming clear, you know, some of these things are unlocking inside of me. But gosh, it's felt like that for the last 10 years for me, that I've been in limbo. So that's how I can relate to that.
Oh, George is waving. Go ahead, George, take the mic, or unless you're just saying hi.
No, I just, I didn't. I watched this movie a couple of weeks ago, and so that was before I printed the play sheet off. But, that third level down, even Cobb himself really was confused about who he was and where he was. He took 2 atoms. He took the totem and a gun. And, of course, the way to get out of the level was to kill yourself or have someone else kill you. But both of them really had to struggle to remember what they consider to be their awakening state, the reality. So I thought that, as they went down 2 layers, they still had a sense of returning back to reality. But once they fell into that third state, that limbo state, they really lost track of what was real and what wasn't. And that's probably the same state that the people that were dreaming 12 hours a day, you know, they lost touch with reality. And to them, the dream seemed the real state. So that's it.
Thank you, George. Regina.
Well, I was going to say exactly what George said, that when they got down to the limbo state, that's when they, like up until that point, again, they were still aware they were dreaming. But when they got down to the limbo state, they lost sight of that. And in fact, that's what happened to Maul. was Maul got into the limbo state and thought that it was reality. And this is what led Cobb to plant the idea in her mind, because he somehow still knew that the limbo wasn't reality, but she didn't. And he was trying to get her to return to reality. So just what George said, that the limbo state is where the forgetfulness really set in. And I did notice the play sheet said something about three levels. And George just mentioned three levels, but I counted three levels plus limbo. The first level was the van. The second level was like a hotel or something. That's when Ariane, how do you say her name? Ari. She was all dressed up with her hair up and had earrings and kind of in a suit, you know. And that's when the van was falling, the loss of gravity happened in the hotel, and he was trying to tie everybody together. And then the third level of the dream that was planned was the snow scene, where the Japanese guy was an old man, and that was the limbo. So that was actually a fourth level down. And then my humble personal opinion is that Cobb actually did not wake up. He went into a fifth level. And from that, there will be no return. You know, he went down into the deep, deep, deep dream where he was getting his desires. And therefore, the dream was so happy, he would have no desire to awaken. Kind of like the rich man in Jesus's parable, right? Yeah.
Thanks for reminding me about that and correcting that. Yeah, you're right. The top level is the hotel, and that was the Charlie Gambit. That's where you tell the mark you're dreaming. Now, the risk is the person's going to realize they're dreaming and wake up, and the whole thing's for naught. That gambit worked, which is really what we're talking about the next. It's an interesting thought you said about Cobb, how he didn't come back from limbo. He went even deeper. But the, you know, just going into the fourth question about the layers, you know, that top layer of the hotel, the analogy I look at it as, we tell ourselves, yeah, I'm interested in awakening. Yeah, I want to awaken, you know, and you reveal a little bit of the truth to yourself, like, well, the world is, you know, you're making it up. You're making up the thoughts about the world and remembering these memories. And just like Don said, and several of you talked about, you're continuing this dream by your thoughts. But then you go deeper, and that's like the analogy of the second layer. He had a militarized subconscious, so he was prepared to defend. Now, what I look at that is our defensive layer that we've unconsciously set up in ourselves, that, you know, sometimes screws everything up, just like a giant freight train, just like in the movie, it showed this freight train coming through the street, messing the whole thing up. And as Regina pointed out, the snowy fortress, which is, you know, equipped with guns, this is where we protect our deepest conditioning and the belief in separation and the self. And, of course, the fourth layer down, I look at is the absolute. That's where it's undifferentiated, and there is no time. It's basically infinitely dilated, because time only exists in the dream, and it seems to slow down. But then, you know, even as we look back, like Don was saying, it seems like a dream when we look back on our experiences. So those are some thoughts I had about the different layers. But does anyone else want to chime in about the layers? This is question four. And then ignore your sheet. There's actually four. Just that put one at the top, which is the hotel, which is layer one. So does anyone else have anything else they want to share about the layers and their insights they had about them? Or were you completely confused? Some people just got like, what layer am I in? And it was very confusing. But yeah, go ahead, Ron.
One of the things that that I noted was this is just the differentiation in time, and I could see how, let's just say in A Course in Miracles just said this, that there was an instant where there was a tiny mad idea and then it was over, but how that could grow into something that actually has lasted millennia, depending how deep the dream goes. It's just the it was just kind of a great object lesson on how, or example of how something like that could really happen, and the way they explained it actually made some intellectual sense too.
Has anyone ever experienced, when they go through a time of intense change or spiritual transformation, a feeling that a lot of time has passed? I have numerous times. Like if you go through this intense thing and your world just gets turned upside down and you lose your reference points, and then you come out the other side, as Don so well says, realizing you didn't get killed and you're not dead and it doesn't kill you. And you're like, oh my God, I'm still here. Okay. But it feels like forever has just passed. And some of you are shaking your head. To me, that's the dilation of time. We've literally, if time only exists for our awakening, you've literally sped up time by going through that. I mean, that to me makes a lot of sense. And you're kind of unfolding that sheet of paper slowly, or however you want to think of it, which is a little bit different than how time was portrayed in the movie. But if we look at it from sort of an opposite standpoint, the deeper you go, and the, quote unquote, the more conditioning you let go of, the more of these reference points we've held onto, we're willing to surrender and let go of and go into the unknown and give up ego and give up being right. We give up our identities in of the things we do, as we're talking about in year three. We're speeding up time. We're doing what the only purpose for being here is. So if you do it quickly, if you go through those things, to me, that's the reason why time dilates and feels like an eternity from just the other day before that big transformation happened. That doesn't happen every day for me. That happens periodically throughout my journey. I don't know if this is a true statement or not, Regina, but I would think that as I progress, that would increase. Those experiences would happen more often. Or maybe it would be different for each one of us. I don't really know. But my overall point is that time is for us to awaken. That's it. The only purpose. Like, what else are we doing here? Looking good, acting spiritual, being successful, having our relationships, being quote unquote happy in the dream. You know, as Shauna pointed out, no, hiking doesn't make me happy. I mean, it does, but is that the source of my happiness? Or is it that maybe when I see that beautiful view off of, what is the point there that we look over the 14,000 point, Mexican guy, what's his name? Cordoba. Yeah, Cordoba. You know, I am in the moment. That's the real reason why I'm happy. I have forgotten about the past. I'm not thinking about the future. Oh, and all this bliss suddenly comes up, and we think that it's because of the 14,000 or 11,500 foot view. Or is it because my mind happens to be still at that moment and I'm not thinking at all? And so then the question is how do I do that all the time? Because they won't let you just camp at Cordoba Pass perpetually and live there. They would eventually kick you out. So go ahead, George, take it away.
thank you, Jay. Time speed has seemed to, can't talk. Time has a sense of speeding up as I've gotten older, you know, and I kind of wonder, you know, when you're a child, you're looking forward with anticipation. And as you get older, you're trying to put the brakes on because, at least I am, trying to put the brakes on because I know that statistically, as time passes, eventually George will be no more. So, anyway, that was just my thought that, I turn around and I'm a year older. It's like, whoa, let's just stop for a while and back up.
Yeah, let's get that time to slow down. And our spiritual time to speed up, right? You know, I remember a teaching that was, I think, in the Buddhist course, and Regina has echoed this numerous times, about we don't know the success from the failure. You know, and we, the more we cling to a successful life in the way we think we want it, according to our conditioning, is that really success? Is that really happiness, or is that just perpetuating the dream? You know, to go deeper, I have to face all the things that I think I want to make me happy. And the truth is they're, like I mentioned, they're only happy because at the moments I have them, I'm not thinking. I'm in the moment. But, you know, I come back to that vision I had of that beautiful place I was that felt so not here. And how contented I felt. That was a contentment that was penetrating. Oh, it was so contented. I mean, I can't even describe it. It was just, I could never in that state imagine anything being different or even wanting it to be different. It was just so happy and fulfilled and complete. And, you know, then I had to wake up here or go back to sleep, whatever you want to call it. And it just felt like two-dimensional compared to three-dimensional. And, you know, for me, going in deeper to me is, I guess, grace takes me over the final threshold, right? I can't work my way there. I think it's maybe it's already there, and I just have to stop trying to get there and just be there, right? Who is it that was saying earlier? Maybe it was Dawn. We're thinking and we're where we're at because there's some part of us that wants to be there. We have to own that. Some part of us that doesn't want to awaken. There's some part of us that puts the hand down when you say, "Oh, but do you want to be awakened right now?" Well, maybe not. You know, there's that. We got to own that. You know, and I like George. You know. What do I want? That's, you know, it just goes back to the drive. What do you want to call it? The desire, the spiritual aspiration. It's more than that. It's a gut that you want this so much that you're willing to sacrifice and let go of the things you think are going to make you happy. Not because you may not still be doing them. Heck, Regina wound up in the exact area of the country that she always dreamed of being in. Right after she and got this beautiful place to live, after she went through this massive letting go of this decade's dream, and then it didn't matter one way or another to her when she got it. So, I mean, it's just funny and crazy how life works out. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. And it doesn't matter, right, because that's not what makes us happy. Question six, Cobbs planted a thought in his wife Mal's mind about the real world not being real, and the only way to get back to reality is to die in waking life. This idea took hold, and she later committed suicide, believing that this was the way out. What teaching does this point to, and what misunderstanding did she have? Does anyone want to answer that one? Question number six. Regina?
Yeah, I'm not sure what teaching it points to, but I can tell you what this did for me. I know that I have planted ideas in people's heads. And I know that those ideas have changed people's lives. And so what this really led me to think about was it really led me to contemplate very deeply about whether I should be so willing to share my own thoughts about someone else's life when they may listen to me and the ideas that I share may dramatically change their life. It led me to contemplate, I'm going to call it my own inceptions. And, you know, maybe sometimes there's very clear guidance to do so, but I think I want to double check that before making suggestions to other people about their lives, because I could sit here and list a large number of things that I have said to people that has led them to make drastic changes to their life. Yeah, and that's all I want to say about it at this point. Thanks.
That's a really good point. I guess I'd like to think it, that if it was spirit coming through us, that it's spirit.
Jacqueline says to people in the room.
Jacqueline. George, go ahead.
Actually, Susan had her hand up first. Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, darn, we scared Sue away. No, I wanted to hear what she had to say.
I'm here. Can you hear me? See me?
Yeah, I can hear and see you, yes.
Oh, there you go. I did it right. Okay. I watched this movie several times, but it wasn't recently. My son is a film student, and this is his favorite director, so I often see Christopher Nolan films, even when I don't want to, when he's home. But we had a discussion about this when I told him it was in the discussion group for the month. And his answer to Mal was different than mine. I didn't show him this question, but we discussed her. And his answer was fanaticism. And I didn't think of that at first. But then when he explained it, the fact that Cobb could not get the inception he planted in her mind out of her mind when they were back in the real world. And it kind of drove her to suicide again, and he couldn't stop it. And I was fixated on why if he could plant it there once, why couldn't he plant the reverse of it? And that just led me down this whole discussion in my own mind of how separate we are and what our own beliefs are so individual, and he just couldn't do it, and that was his torturing, and that was, he lost her and the whole bit. But my son's answer was, it's fanaticism, like she became a fanatic. And he related this to certain members of distant family who are so far fanatical Christian that even the priests tell them to stop and calm down, that it's wrong. But I thought the answer was fascinating in fanaticism. And I could see that she was so fixated on a belief, and that belief, whether she died for it, whether it was real or not, she was willing to go that far, but not willing, the subconscious wasn't willing to let something else be planted or incepted in her that could undo that thinking. So that's my answer. Thank you.
Beautiful insight, Susan, and really well spoken about here in Awakening Together. We have our five core values, which help protect us against what we always call dogmatism or fundamentalism, which is, to me, the same thing as extremism. But what the mind will do once it latches onto an idea is unlimited in terms of, look at Hitler, look at genocide, when a belief takes root and the desire and identity goes with it, it's very hard to reverse. And it can lead to great destructive acts, and which are what they are, not good or bad. That's just what it does. It goes down an insane track to a suicidal end, no pun intended. But does that really get us anywhere is the question. We're free to explore this illusion as much as we want, but it's not going to get us anywhere. None of that's going to wake us up. Our refusal to look never wakes us up. We think that we're going to be happy. Mount Mall thought she was going to be happy and be in paradise by killing her actual body. She believed that. To even her own kids, she sacrificed a love for her own children. That's how strong it was in her mind. And so for me, I look at that as the reverse and say, my commitment to letting go of my thinking, my false thinking anyway, as Regina talked about it, how Bernadette described it, has to be that total to let go of it. you know, and that's desire is building in me. It isn't that strong. It's taking time and incrementally increasing, and I get inspired and it keeps increasing. But yeah, that's so true, Susan. George, did you have anything to share, or Don? George, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this will be brief. You know, the people that most of us, if we have children, have planted ideas in their minds are our children. And not necessarily from what we've said to them, you know, don't do what I do what I say. All right. They see that by the example that we set, not necessarily the words that we use. And so that was the only comment I wanted to make at all. I know we've got a short amount of time here, so I'll drop.
Yeah, Don, thank you, George. Yeah, it's true. Our kids, I don't have kids. I have Augusta, and he's like the closest thing to a kid. And I can see how many ideas I've planted in his mind and how much it affected his life. So I can definitely understand what Regina's talking about and what you're talking about. Go ahead, Don.
So much I'm saying is there's such a powerful teaching in this movie, planting an idea. What I'm learning is that's where the actions that you take, the reactions that you do, your behavior comes from the thoughts you think. And I'm going to share something deeply personal. When I was undoing or getting to the turnaround part of I'm not good enough, you go through and you try to list all the reasons why the turnaround, in this case, I'm good enough, why it could be as true or truer. Three of them were, one, I want to live. I don't want to give up. I don't want to give up on life. So as I was going back over and reviewing, because that was my commitment for 30 days, I'm still in the 30-day challenge of going back over these insights that I've really went deep into. I made a little side note and realized, oh my God, that is the antidote to suicide, to wanting to commit suicide. If you truly believe and you get to that feeling, I want to live. I don't want to give up. I don't want to give up on life. That's it. Because your actions are going to come from your beliefs, whatever you're believing. So in this movie where he planted the idea in his wife's mind about killing herself, that's exactly how it goes. And it's as simple as believing a thought, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthless, can literally drive someone to want to commit suicide. And there's probably people could be taking their lives right now because they believe that so strongly, and they don't even realize, they haven't even made the connection of that it's such a core belief in them, and that would make them drive them to do an action that they can't undo. So I just wanted to share that because, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Dawn. Yeah, and realizing that we have a choice is also a big thing that's taught in suicide hotlines, is realizing you have a choice, because people don't think they have a choice when they get that far down into the thinking, right? They don't think they have a choice. You know, and what Course in Miracles, and this is to address Lulu's comment, I'm not sure if this directly answers Lulu's comment, but the whole thing in Course in Miracles is choose again, choose again, choose again. I can choose right now. I don't have to do this. I don't have to believe these things this person said about me. I don't have to believe that. I don't have to.
One other thing is that in the Course in Miracles, it does talk about once you see the world as an illusion, because that's what he was telling his wife too. That what when he planted the idea in her, he was telling her the very same. It kind of freaked me out for a moment when I first saw the movie, because I was like, oh my God, that's some of the things that we say in Course in Miracles, that the world is an illusion, this and that. And I was thinking how one of our workbook lessons talks about if you only see that, but you don't take it to the next step. like, okay, there's a lesson about this world is an illusion, but then the next lesson is, but there's a real world, and beyond this world is the world I want. So it takes you out of that stuck mentality that the world is useless, nothing, it's not real or whatever, but and it gets you to the other side. But if someone were to just get stuck in the one part and all you can see, oh, the world is an illusion, and then it's almost like you're pushing everyone and everything away, you're isolating yourself because, oh, that's not real, you're not real. And so that can make your life pretty doggone miserable.
Yeah, that's so the philosophy.
I just wanted to bring that to a point because when I heard him say those things, I was like, oh my God, did he read the course?
Yeah, there's a you could call it a philosophy, but it's more like a mental illness called solipsism, that if you ever take courses in psychology or philosophy, it's an actual philosophy that basically states that you don't think anyone is real, and that it's a completely self-centered, in a false sense way, idea that you are a figment of my imagination. And then that leads down a very delusional track, right?
I was part of that's how they view it. So
yeah, that's definitely delusion and misunderstanding, and what Michael Langford calls a hijacking of the teaching, which is what the mind is good at. The mind loves to hijack teachings and pervert the teaching for the sake of the preservation of the idea of the separation. And it's really good you see that, Dawn. I don't think we can talk about this enough. I think we need to constantly be talking about how the ego uses strategies to preserve itself. That is, if the more they're exposed and out in the open, they can't hide. The kid's got the crumbs on the face, the hand in the cookie jar. He's busted. You're caught. you can't do it anymore. So there's maybe time for one more question. I threw out a question on the sheet. What is your view of responsibility for thought? We've been talking about that. The correction of the thought, that's kind of what Dawn referenced, is, okay, yes, you have the thought, I'm making this all up, but then where do you go? Right here is the answer that I have to that. You go where you always were. It's the journey without distance, the journey without words. You are free of thought and therefore can be in the presence. And I think you yourself, Dawn, described that very well with the little experiments you were doing recently, contemplations. Hey, Craig, welcome, brother. Good to see you. I'm 3 minutes left, brother. It's all yours. Hey, Lulu, good to see your face. Thanks for sending me that song, Lulu. I look forward to working with music stuff on you. That's going to be a blast.
Right on. Do we have time for one more question?
Yeah, go for it, Lulu. Yeah, please. Speak.
Yeah, can we go back to the fifth layer? And because that confused me, because it seemed like it all reconciled. He talked about, he said something in reconciliation and catharsis. So I was just wondering if we could talk about that fifth level. And I don't know, because Jesus in the Course talks about the certainty of the return. And the fifth level seemed like not a good place. So I was looking for clarity on that. Thanks, guys.
Ron, go ahead. You had a thought. Go ahead.
Yeah, I liken the fifth level, but potentially us being born into this world. We don't remember. We don't remember what had taken place. And the few that do remember are kind of tracing back, what was it I supposed to remember? Oh, yeah, I knew a guy once. I don't know where that thought, I had a token. What was that? It kind of like flashes that came back. And so I don't know if there was kind of a working the way back. What we're trying to do in this world is get our kick back up to the next level or two, back up through consciousness into awareness. So I didn't see that as our destiny is moving down and getting stuck in there. Our destiny is we started there and we're moving our way back up. In a sense, is was kind of my my take on it.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way, Ron. And it was confusing enough for most people to follow all those levels. Most people got lost in that. But I almost can do the complete reverse, where if we compare that fifth level to true awareness, we could say that is, as we give up on the beliefs and thinking, that is what's revealed to us. But not everyone sees it that way. But I think that the overall theme is the deeper into layers of fantasy you get, the more deluded you get, and the more forgetting there is. That was the theme in the movie. The deeper you go into this fantasy, you keep forgetting more. So with that is a good point to end. And I'll turn it back to you, Dawn. Thanks to everyone for participating. Hope to see you next month. Bye-bye.